loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we'll talk again about the wave of mail bombings being sent out to high-profile figures across the country and the profound effect it's having on politics. And then today we continue our weekly series. It happens every Thursday, and it's called Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of the courts, the prosecutors, the police, and how justice is denied to so many people in this country.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, according to the Associated Press, the Trump administration leaked today that it will send 800 troops to the border with Mexico in advance of the arrival of the migrant caravan from Central America. These active duty members of the U.S. Army and Air Force will join 2,100 National Guardsmen already on the border. President Trump said that, absent the military, quote, it would be impossible to protect our border, unquote. Next, in a stunning prediction, Ben Hodges, the commander of U.S. forces in Europe from 2014 to 2017, told an audience at the Warsaw Security Forum that there is, quote, a very strong likelihood that we will be at war with China within 15 years, unquote. What can the world do to avert such a catastrophic conflict? Then, type the words Erdogan slams into Google and you'll get a long list, including the US, the UN, the EU, France, Germany, and the Netherlands. Compare that to the Turkish president's latest statement about Saudi Arabia, which is, quote, I have no reason to doubt the king's honesty, unquote. He's referring to the Saudi murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Saudi Arabia's Davos in the Desert Investment Summit has just finished, with billions of dollars in new investment being planned for the kingdom. Erdogan understands that. Why let the death of one journalist get in the way of Turkey's share of the profits? And then the New York Stock Exchange and the Nasdaq have experienced extreme volatility over the past week, with daily swings of as much as 5%. Indeed, the markets are down so much this week that the entire year's gains have been wiped out. What accounts for this volatility? And is it temporary, or is it something we should get used to? And finally, there was a debate last night in Florida between the two gubernatorial candidates, Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum and Congressman Ron DeSantis. Actually, it was less of a debate than it was a bare-knuckle brawl. DeSantis said that Gillum as governor would allow pedophiles to have free rein in Florida, and Gillum said that DeSantis was the candidate of neo-Nazis and white supremacists. In the meantime, news broke that the FBI had earlier tried to set up Gillum on a criminal charge by giving him free tickets to the musical Hamilton. And in other headlines, the Saudi-led coalition bombed fruit and vegetable stands yesterday in Yemen, killing at least 21 civilians, including children. The airstrike hit a market near the vital port of Hodeidah, which the Yemeni people depend on for aid shipments. Mullah Abdulghani Baradar, a co-founder and top figure in the Taliban, has been released from a Pakistani prison. The release comes as a result of negotiations that took place in Qatar, where the Taliban has a political office. Baradar had been captured in 2010. Former French President Nicolas Sarkozy's legal problems got worse today as an appeals court judge ruled that an inquiry into his violation of campaign finance laws should go ahead. Prosecutors allege that Sarkozy used fake invoices to raise nearly double the legal limit of donations. After asking on air earlier this week why blackface is racist, Megyn Kelly is out at NBC. She's currently set to have her $69 million contract paid in full. NBC hired her in 2017 after 13 years at Fox News, despite her racist comments there. While at Fox, she infamously made a fuss about the idea of a black Santa, insisting on the air that both Santa and Jesus were white, stating, quote, just because it makes you feel uncomfortable doesn't mean it has to change, unquote. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the terrorist threats and attacks against different political leaders. Even more pipe bombs were found this morning, this time addressed to former Vice President Joe Biden and to actor Robert De Niro, both critics of Donald Trump, obviously. Yesterday, bombs were sent to Bill and Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, two members of Congress, former CIA Director John Brennan, former Attorney General Eric Holder and the CNN, the bomber is clearly targeting opponents of President Trump. While the president has denounced these attacks, his main political response so far has been to blame the media not only for treating him unfairly, but also for inciting hatred in the country. We're joined from New York by Jim Cavanaugh, the editor of thepolemicist.net, and from Virginia by Joe Loria, the editor of Consortium News. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Brian.
Thanks for having me.
Joe Loria, this is obviously a big deal. I mean, these were real bombs. In the case of Robert De Niro, a private security cop who was a former police officer had actually, I think, if I'm not incorrect on this, had delivered the package to De Niro's office and then was only watching the news last night and thought, oh, wait, let's go back, and found out that indeed that package included a bomb. So this is a real thing. These are real devices. They can really kill people, injure people. Lou Dobbs, who, of course, of CNN fame, who was, you know, he had the anti-immigrant hour for a long time on CNN. He tweeted, fake news, fake bombs. Who could possibly benefit by so much fakery? Of course, that's also the message of a lot of the sort of right-wing, ultra-right, alt-right, that this was just a Democratic ploy. It's not a ploy, or it doesn't seem to be a ploy. It certainly, if the bombs went off, they would have done real damage. Anyway, go ahead. Let's get your take.
Well, it's not only alt-right. There's a kind of orthodox left out there, too, that's been saying that Hillary Clinton was behind this, or they think that she may have been.
Yeah, I saw somebody said Hillary Clinton sent those bombs.
Yeah. Well, if anybody on that amongst the victims would have arranged that, would have been Brennan, and I don't buy that story. However, I should say the New York Times this morning, and I'm going to quote directly this line, none of the devices have harmed anyone so far, and it was not immediately clear whether they could have actually exploded. So what I heard yesterday was that the bomb sent to CNN was a live bomb, but this was CNN quoting law enforcement. So whether they were all real bombs or fake, I don't know. But it was a real threat. It has to be taken seriously. On the larger question, I think we'll talk about in more depth here, about who's responsible for this environment, this hyper-partisan environment that allowed someone to do this, I would say both sides. Both Trump, of course, has done a lot to create this, and so has the media. And as Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the White House press spokeswoman, said yesterday, that she wouldn't blame Bernie Sanders for that guy who shot up some Republicans who was a Sanders supporter. So no one should directly blame Trump for this. I think that's correct. However, he's definitely contributed to this climate. As I watched CNN yesterday, I was waiting for how long it would take for them to turn their guns on Trump. And at the beginning, they just reported it straight as a news story. This is what we know. This is what's happening. And then little by little, they turned to Trump. And I shut it off, put it back on later, and it was pure blame and hatred of Trump for what he'd done, basically saying that he'd licked the stamps himself and put it on the envelopes. And then I caught Trump's son on Fox later in the evening, and he was saying that he'd watched CNN and the hostility towards his father. So that's, I think, what Trump was responding to. So this is a bloody mess, and everybody involved here is responsible to some degree.
Jim Cavanaugh, there's lots of reports, both in the, quote, mainstream media and also in alternative media, media from the left and the right, about whether or not these were real bombs that could hurt people, that could blow up, or whether they were fake bombs and simply meant sort of as a form of sort of sick theater or as a prank. When you hear these different reports, and of course, we're not the investigators, we don't actually know, but when you hear these kind of different reports, what's your reaction?
Well, yeah, it seems to me that from what I've seen, the police are saying that there was explosive powder in these devices, so that makes them inherently dangerous. They're also saying that they were very poorly constructed, and there were a lot of things about them that made it unclear whether they would ever have gone off. But under any circumstance, it's some kind of bizarre, intimidating tactic that's meant to create fear and to upset the political, to create a kind of, I hate the word terrorism, but a kind of terrifying environment in the political atmosphere. So that's something that we have to take seriously. And whoever's done this, it's clearly one person. And they seem to have used a lot of kind of personal delivery methods, not necessarily by them personally, but they used couriers and they put things in mailboxes. So, you know, this is something that has to be investigated, has to be taken seriously, that we all have to realize this is a horrible thing to be doing in the political atmosphere. And we have to find out who did it. And we shall see.
Right. And if it's what you're really saying, I believe, is that it may be more than one person, but it's the same source, because all of these things seem to be similar. At least that's what we're hearing from the media, which is getting its information from FBI and from law enforcement investigators. We want to talk, because there's a lot that we don't know about what actually has happened, or as we can see, more packages were being delivered today, what might continue to happen. But we want to try to make heads or tails out of the politics of what's going on. And to that, and before I come back to you, Joe Lurie, I want to play a short audio clip from Donald Trump. It's him last night after the news of these bombs being sent to Democratic Party leaders, including former President Barack Obama. Let's listen.
The media also has a responsibility to set a civil tone and to stop the endless hostility and constant negative and oftentimes false attacks and stories. Have to do it.
All right, that was Donald Trump. Okay, so he's basically saying, in response to groups or entities like CNN that say it's Trump's rhetoric that brought this on, or the other Democratic Party talking points, this was Donald Trump who made this thing happen because of his divisive rhetoric or his attacks against the Democratic Party leaders or against the CNN. Donald Trump is throwing it back and saying, well, look, actually, the atmosphere in the country is created by the media. Now, I want to play a second audio clip from Donald Trump, and then, Joe Lurie, get you to respond to both. Let's listen.
And by the way, do you see how nice I'm behaving tonight? This is like, have you ever seen this? We're all behaving very well. And hopefully we can keep it that way, right? We're going to keep it that way.
That's a second part of Donald Trump's message. Joe Lurie, let's talk about both. One, Donald Trump saying, look, it's the media's fault, basically. And two, he's telling the crowd kind of coyly, see how well I'm behaving? Anyway, what's your take?
Well, I mean, that first clip that you played, he says the media also has to behave better. Well, I'm not sure what that also means. Is he saying also that, including that I have to behave better and also the media? Or was that a long list of things he was saying? The Democratic politicians have to behave better and the media also has to behave. So I'm not quite sure the context of that remark. If he was saying they also have to do it because both sides have to tone this down, then I agree with that. I think both sides have to turn this down. That's what I said, I think, in my first remark here, that they're both responsible for this. Trump, being the president, has a huge responsibility not to inflame passions, as he does on a routine basis. And he does. The other day, he was out in Montana, and he more or less praised the congressman who had body slammed a reporter from The Guardian that just a few days ago. So he was condoning violence, basically, against a reporter. So now we see a package sent to CNN. It was really addressed to John Brennan at CNN. They got it wrong because they thought that Brennan worked at CNN. He actually is a talking head at MSNBC. But it did go to a media headquarters. So Trump is definitely riling up this hatred of the press, but the press has given it back. And is that not the role of the media either? As I said, CNN's coverage became just pure hostility towards Trump, as if he had been directly responsible for this. He's indirectly responsible for creating the environment that in which this could happen. But, you know, this deep partisan divide here that I've never seen in my life in the United States it precedes Trump to a great extent. He's certainly exacerbated it. But this is the heart of the matter here. People feel powerless, and then they start identifying with their tribe, with their political party tribe, and the hatred gets to such an extent that someone here has thought that they could do something about it by trying to kill or intimidate big critics of Trump. People who have, by the way, like Maxine Waters and Eric Holder, have been getting going down into the gutter with Trump and using very, very volatile language that they normally would not have used if it wasn't Trump. I do not believe Eric Holder would have said the things that he did. I'm trying to remember precisely what they were, but there's things such as, you know, we're not going to just take this lying down and we have to fight back and et cetera. So they're using tough language. They got two of these bombs. Brennan, as we all know, tweeted, you know, unbelievable things about Trump being a traitor because he went and met the leader of North Korea, or he met President Putin of Russia. So this made him a traitor. I mean, so he went overboard, and Trump's reacting to that. And I have to say, when Trump says that the media is the enemy of the people, I think he's talking about the enemy of Trump. He's talking about himself. But I think in many ways the media has become not the friend of the public, but they serve a much more powerful interest than the public. As far as the second quote, well, Trump is a comedian, I have to say it. And I mean that in a negative way, as well as him being funny. He was saying that he was basically telling us how cynical he is, that he's behaving himself now only because of what happened earlier in the day with the bombs. Not a called for remark. When he says, let's keep it that way, does he really mean it? Let's keep it that way. So the guy did not perform extremely well yesterday. Let's put it that way.
That's the voice of Joe Loria. Joe is the editor of Consortium News. We're also joined from New York by Jim Kavanaugh, the editor of thepolemicist.net. Yeah, I think Joe Loria is taking us down the right road here in one important way, Jim Kavanaugh. Not that he's not taking us down the road correctly in many ways, but I want to emphasize one way, which is it seems that the protocol, the established and acceptable protocol of how politicians conduct themselves and how the media conducts itself in relationship to politicians, meaning within the elites, among the elites, that has basically shattered in this last political cycle, you know, starting with the 2016 election campaign, where you have the president of the United States basically denouncing the intelligence services that are under his leadership, denouncing the main anchors of the corporate-owned media as being fake news. Those same media outlets saying that the president of the United States is actually a stooge and an agent for a foreign adversarial power. That kind of protocol that allowed ruling class factions to fight it out with each other, but in public to appear to be sort of urbane, gentlemanly, et cetera, so as not to rile up the masses of people in such a profound way as we're actually indicating, it seems like America has entered a new realm in a very different way of ruling for a ruling class set of institutions.
Yeah, well, I think that's true. I think Trump did disrupt that in his campaign in 2016. I think there's an enormous amount of anger out there in the population. And I think the Democrat, the elite political class doesn't want to provoke that, didn't want to provoke it, wants to try and manage it in their own way. And Trump disrupted that. He tapped right into the anger. Unfortunately, he did it in the wrong way, in the right-wing way. He did it by directing that anger at Mexicans and Mexican rapists and this and that and the other and racism. And he hooked up with a right-wing racist views. But and the ruling class wants to put that anger back in the bottle. But it's not going to happen. Now, this hasn't. It's not like this wasn't these kinds of nasty. This may not be the nastiest time in American politics in some way. These nasty attitudes were out there. Don't forget, we had an assassination of a president, and we had people running in Dallas before John Kennedy came to Dallas. You know, posters saying he was a treason, he has to be assassinated. The newspaper advertisement. So this has happened before. But what you have now is, as you say, this is now being fought out in the media and in the public media and the elite media. And you've got all this very nasty anger that's out there. And I would like to see that anger being directed positively, you know, in the right direction, in left populist. People should be angry about the fact that children have to go out and do GoFundMes to get their diabetes medicine. I mean, we should be furious about that. And that should be directed towards Medicare for All. It's Trump who has been the one who was willing to tap into that anger. And it's too bad. And it's not going to get any better. It's not going to get any better.
Jim is right. This isn't the first period of extreme political polarization and instability and anger. He's also right. When John F. Kennedy was killed, even though the common narrative is that the country came together in grief and mourning, In fact, a whole lot of right-wingers in America were celebrating the killing of John F. Kennedy. When Martin Luther King Jr. was killed, of course, the black community and all of those people who opposed racism stood up and spoke out. But there were people who were celebrating the murder of Martin Luther King. This isn't really new. And there's been lots of political assassinations of both political leaders and people who were leaders of social justice movements. Not that new. But Joe, I want to just sort of go deeper into trying to understand, why has this kind of division been so openly on display in the last 2 years from within the factions of elite circles who, again, normally talk to each other, even if they disagree with each other, in sort of a polite way? Is it because it's driven by the 24/7 news cycle, by constant media coverage? Or is it, or is there some other deeper sort of unsettled divisions as a consequence, perhaps maybe of the U.S. Changed status in the world, within the world politics, or the problems of working people domestically in America? How do you account for it?
I think you're absolutely right that there's always been anger. The working class has never gotten a good deal in this country, so there's pent-up anger. There's been racism from way back, from the beginning of the country, obviously. So there have been always reasons why there's anger at the bottom towards people at the top. But you correctly point out that amongst the people at the top, you rarely see this kind of rhetoric that we're now seeing. And for example, we never heard anybody from the Democratic, from anyone in the elite, accusing anyone else of being behind JFK's murder. There was always talk that Bobby Kennedy suspected LBJ had a hand in it and may have even confronted him. But we do not know that. But today, the main reason difference has to be Trump. He has changed the climate and the rhetoric 100%. Although it was starting before, but they always kept that decorum. With some people, for example, we saw Kavanaugh, not our guest, but Brett Kavanaugh, our other guest. Well, look at the way he behaved at that hearing. It was unbelievable. The way a guy trying to get on the court, screaming, yelling, crying, accusing Democratic senators and asking them what they drank. And it was a display never before seen, probably, at a confirmation hearing of anyone, let alone a Supreme Court justice. And apparently he was coached, not by Trump, but someone in the legal counsel in the White House, that he better go in there guns blazing. That was his only chance. I'm sure that he was really angry. But I had a lot of people on social media telling, when I condemned his behavior, that I was, you know, that I would have been angry too if this had happened to me. They were justifying and supporting Trump, Kavanaugh's reaction, even if he was falsely accused. This is not the way to react to that in the normal circumstances of a Senate hearing. It didn't go down one of the great moments in the U.S. Senate. So the whole atmosphere has changed, and I do have to give that to Trump. But there's also one other point I want to make about I think there's an hypocrisy in the corporate media by going on and on again about what I just said is true. Trump has made this climate even more dangerous and even more vile and more divisive than it was before. But what has the corporate media done internationally, globally, by peddling the Russia story without evidence, creating tension between two nuclear superpowers? They've created that climate on a much bigger scale and much more dangerous in a way than Trump has. But of course, they don't see it that way. They just see Trump as the only problem. And they have devolved. It's devolved. It's not journalism, what I saw yesterday. It's a personal feud with Trump. Now, even if he baited them and he's baiting them, you don't respond that way if you're a professional journalist. So that's why I'm blaming both sides here. But the ultimate question of why the elites are fighting like this, why we're seeing this fought out at that level, and it's a disgrace, is Trump started this because that's who he is. We knew that's who he was when he was coming into office. And I think he's having a good time about it myself.
Jim Kavanaugh, Joe Lauria's position is a little bit nuanced here. I think Joe is right in part, but I would also add that the media allowed themselves to be baited by Donald Trump. It was Donald Trump, I think, that originally lowered the bar, lowered the standard of conversation, encouraged people to do the same thing, calling names, lying Ted Cruz, crazy Bernie Sanders, leading chants of lock her up. The press let him get away with it. And then when he complained about the press and baited the press, they walked right into his trap. And so it seems to me that the entire debate now has been lowered, that this may be a permanent situation, and that while we do have both sides to blame, I think Donald Trump started this fight.
I go back to the Fox News effect over the past 20 years, which has been very divisive and very, very aggressive, okay? And with it, then bringing social media into it, that got ramped up even more so. And Donald Trump has been the epitome of that and has taken it to a new level. And we have a huge problem of political education in the country and miseducation that both sides, certainly the Democratic side is not helping, is miseducating people too. And you're just going to get more and more anger. I don't see this getting any better because of the social media effect. And it's going to be driven in ways that are hard to comprehend and hard to see any good coming of it.
Yeah. Joe Lauria, actually, we had another 30 seconds. We'll give you the final word.
Well, I second what was just said. And I said that Trump was mostly responsible for this. He changed the dynamic amongst the elites, but I do not believe the media should be responding this way. They should take a higher road here and just report the news and report what he says and let people figure out what's going on without making this a personal fight where it's unwatchable TV. And we're going down some road that I think we've never seen before, and maybe not since the early days of this republic when we had the pamphleteers and the people of founding fathers hating one another. This was an elite fight that we saw. But now we're seeing it today with social media exacerbating it. It's quite unprecedented in some ways and not encouraging in terms of solving the many problems we've got in this country. I think it's only going to make things absolutely worse.
That's the voice of Joe Lauria. We were talking to Joe from Virginia. Joe is the editor of the Consortium News. We were also joined from New York City by Jim Kavanaugh. Jim is the editor of the polemicist.net. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our weekly series, Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of our courts and prosecutors and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. We're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we're joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. And he's also the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Welcome back, guys.
Hi, thanks for having us on the show.
Thank you.
You have flagged for us a very interesting piece from The Guardian, a newspaper that I love. And it's about a former Black liberation activist and longtime prisoner, Mike Africa Sr. He was actually released from prison after serving 40 years. Kevin, why don't you start us off and tell us about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is quite important. But again, we have another Black liberation leader who was in jail for decades. If you recall, following the cases of the Angola 3 and having those cases very high profile in the news. Of course, MOVE, this group was a group that was targeted in Pennsylvania. In fact, bombed, attacked. The city dropped a bomb. The fire spread between homes, and the law enforcement watched as everything burned. It's one of the most egregious cases of a government forces actually targeting a radical group in the United States history. But it's good that after all this time that Mike Africa fortunately is able to leave prison. In a lot of cases, these revolutionaries would just die in prison and they would not be released, or they would get cancer and they would look for compassionate release and they would not be allowed to leave. But in this case, he was able to get released.
Now, let's talk about that case a little bit, too. This was a very, very controversial case. It was a controversial trial in Philadelphia back in, I think it was 1978. The police laid siege to a house in which the Operation MOVE people were living. One shot was fired. That one shot killed a policeman. The police were never able to figure out who fired that shot. And so everybody was prosecuted for murder, and they were all convicted. Now, Mike Africa's wife, Debbie Africa, was 8 months pregnant at the time. She was also convicted of murder, and she spent 40 years in prison. She was just paroled in June. This is the first time they've seen each other in 40 years, and they've been married for 40 years. Their son, who was born in 1978 while his mother was in prison, has never seen his parents in the same room together, ever, in his life. This is a pretty dramatic development.
Yeah, and that was, you know, the Philadelphia police, who, you know, frankly, were one of the most racist, disgustingly racist,
famously
violent
so.
Police forces against the Black Panther Party and against others in the Black Liberation Movement.
I'm not sure if they still merit the past tense, but...
yeah. And the reason I was hesitating is, like, when you line up Chicago, New York, Philadelphia, Los Angeles, it's hard to say, like, who's worse.
It's a real race to the bottom, exactly.
It's a race to the bottom. But, you know, the MOVE organization had been targeted, again, early in the mid-70s. Mumia Abu-Jamal was writing about what was happening in the war between the Philadelphia police and the MOVE organization. And then Mumia himself had obviously been targeted. Mumia joined the Black Panther Party, not MOVE, back when he was 15 years old, and he functioned as a communications specialist. Mumia is still in prison, but we have a situation where this was in 78. 7 years later is when the Philadelphia police dropped the bomb on the house.
Literally dropped a bomb on a house.
Yeah, and only
a helicopter.
And only one person survived, Ramona Africa, who's been on this show. She was sent to prison. Her kids were killed. The animals were killed. The other MOVE members, they were incinerated. And then the fire chief said, let it burn. It's in a black middle-class neighborhood in Philadelphia. And all the houses burned down. That's part of this story. And again, I don't think Paul Wright, I don't think that many people in America actually know about that, even though it's not ancient history.
No, I think this goes down, I think, to the whole suppression of, you know, to the whole suppression of our history, and especially of, you know, police state atrocities and things like that. It's interesting because I was just having a conversation this morning with one of my coworkers here at HRDC about the use of prisoners for medical experiments. And they weren't familiar with the fact that before the mid-1970s, every drug and every cosmetic that was put on the market in this country was tested on prisoners. And it's interesting that, you know, that this isn't that long ago. It's still within living memory. It's not ancient history. It's not like, hey, everyone involved in that has died. But, you know, it's just interesting that, you know, how good of a job I think both the mainstream media and our education system does in pushing stuff down the memory hole. And I think it's like, you know, I'm the one that likes to say that George Orwell was an optimist. And he's the one that says whoever controls the present controls the past. And that seems to be the norm where, you know, when people are talking about the news coverage or the spate of police violence, it's kind of like, okay, they're forgetting that this has been an ongoing thing, because, you know, we see it for the last 50 years, at least, police violence. It's been a major cause of riots and urban uprisings, going back to the Watts riot in 1965. I mean, you know, this has been a constant for, especially for poor communities of color in this country for decades. Yet each new shooting, each new atrocity is treated as if it's never happened before, that somehow this is a new development. And I think that, in a lot of respects, I think that, you know, the media, I think, kind of perpetuates that by not giving any type of historical perspective or just, okay, this is just the latest chapter in a long book.
Yeah. The MOVE House, again, for our audience, if you want to look it up, it was bombed by the police on May 13th, 1985. 500 Philadelphia cops showed up that morning. They surrounded the house. 500, that's a lot of police. They surrounded the police. The police commissioner made a long speech saying basically to the MOVE people, come out. The speech began with the police commissioner, Sambor, over the bullhorn yelling into the microphone, attention, MOVE, this is America. And when the MOVE members did not respond, the police decided to forcefully remove the occupants. That led to a standoff. Finally, they took a helicopter over, this is in the middle of a big residential area in a black neighborhood, middle-class black neighborhood, working-class black neighborhood in Philadelphia. They came over the house with a bomb and dropped it on top of the house. And then the people, according to the accounts of Ramona Africa, the only survivor. People wanted to get out. The house was burning down. Their kids were there. Their children were there. I think it was four or five kids
Five kids. 11 people died, including five children.
They couldn't, but because the police had also set up like firing squads so that if you ran out of the building, you were going to be shot at. She did get out of the building, and I think she was shot, and she survived. Everybody else was incinerated, and then the campaign began, Kevin. It had just begun, but it really went into high gear to explain to all of us why this was correct, why it was justified.
To elaborate on a point you made a minute ago, too, 60 houses burned down. That's the entire neighborhood
burned down.
Yeah, let it
burn. Let it burn. Those were the words of the fire chief. Let it burn. Go ahead, Kevin.
Yeah, so anyone who is not familiar with what we're talking about should watch the documentary Let the Fire Burn. I know that that was probably my introduction to the full story of this as somebody who did not live when this was unfolding. And I would just say that when we talk about all of these cases of revolutionaries like what we're talking about today, I'm struck by how, you know, we don't and aren't supposed to know this history, and that we're not supposed to engage and discuss these cases. I mean, I really do feel like the people in power don't want us to engage with the complexity of what these groups were for, the political violence that they committed, talk about how some of this was in self-defense, talk about how the state was using violence against them, discuss the repression and the ways in which they were trying to control these groups. You know, you have dozens of these people who were radicals engaged in movements, Black Panther Party, et cetera, back in the 70s, early 1980s, and they remain in jail, many of them with very, very long sentences, likely to die in prison. And yet, you know, as we hear about them and they leave prison, for the most part, I would say that most Americans, including myself and people who work in media, have no ability to talk about these cases because they just don't have any grasp at all about what they mean. I mean, you say something like Mike Africa, or you say Mama Africa, you say Pam Africa, you say any of these different people's names, and I think most have no idea how to base that in the history of the civil rights movement or base it in the movements of radical history. They just don't know how to place those people in the history of the United States.
Yeah. Let's just say some of their names. Russell Maroon Schotz, Matula Shakur, the stepfather of Tupac Shakur, Jameel Abdullah Alameen, formerly A$AP Brown, Sundiata Okoli, Veronica Bowers, Eddie Poindexter. He was, by the way, he had been the target of COINTELPRO. He's been in prison all this time. We're talking 40, 50 years
yes.
now. Convicted based on the testimony of a teenage boy who was beaten by the police. Romain Chip Fitzgerald, Kamu Sadiki, Kojo Bomani Sababu, Rochelle McGee, who was part of the Angela Davis trial. When Jonathan Jackson came into the courtroom in San Marin County, August 7th, 1970, a year before his brother, George Jackson, his older brother, was executed. Rochelle McGee was a prisoner who happened to be in the courtroom. He's still in prison. This is like...
From 1970.
Yeah. We're talking, you know, it's... And then you can keep going. I mean, David Gilbert, Reverend Joy Powell. I mean, there's so many people, so many political prisoners in America, and people don't know about them. And the cruelty and barbarism of the American prison system is these people basically don't get out, or they don't get out until they're almost dead. Go to, Paul, you should say what, if you have a list of them, but I know the Alliance for Global Justice, afgj.org. If you go to that website, afgj.org, and look for Political Prisoners USA, they'll give you the entire list. Educate yourself about political prisoners in America.
Yeah. Maybe we should go on to the next topic, too. You know, we're just a week and a half away from elections. And we talked last week about how it's not just these individual races that are so important. There are also a lot of...
I didn't mention Leonard Peltier.
One of the most important political prisoners in America.
I mean, I didn't mention a whole bunch of people, actually. So in a way, it's dangerous to do the list. But
Leonard Peltier, who a lot of us expected would get a presidential pardon at the end of the Obama administration, and that never came to pass.
The Clintons knew that Peltier should be free. They knew that this was an FBI
because
job.
During the Clinton administration, the FBI finally came clean and said that they, in fact, had no evidence to show that Leonard Peltier had fired shots at FBI agents.
No, he was along with Clyde and Vernon Bellecourt and Russell Meads, one of the real important leaders of the American Indian movement. He was targeted and he's still in prison. He's very sick.
Yes, he is.
Anyway, let's keep going.
Yes, we're talking about ballot initiatives. And one of the most important ballot initiatives in the country is in Florida. And that would re-enfranchise a lot of former felons, people who have been convicted of felonies, have done their time, and are no longer on probation or parole. There's a lot of pushback. And this actually came up in last night's gubernatorial debate between Gillum and DeSantis in Florida, with DeSantis accusing Gillum of wanting pedophiles to roam free throughout the state of Florida. Does this rhetoric, Paul, have any real impact on where people stand on issues like this?
You know, I don't know, but what I think, I've been one of the critics of Amendment 4 because one of the problems I see with it is that it excludes people that have been convicted of murder and sex offenses. And you know, in the interest of full disclosure, I'm one of those affected people. I was convicted of murder in 1987 in Washington State. So that was 31 years ago. And I live in Florida. So I'm one of the people that's, you know, excluded from this. And we've been critical of that all along because, and I think this comes down to real important differences in organizing and, you know, what your visions are for America. It's like, you know, do you believe in equality and justice and second chances for everyone? Do you believe everyone gets to be rehabilitated and have sort of civic participation? Or are you excluding people and not allowing them to participate just frankly based on, you know, bigotry and discrimination? And it's interesting because, you know, when I've talked to the people that mostly at the ACLU that put this on the ballot, they said that the reason that they decided to exclude murderers and sex offenders from Amendment 4 is that they did focus groups that said that it wouldn't pass if murderers and sex offenders would have been affected and allowed to regain their right to vote. And I think that's also part of the problem that I think what happens when you base your political decisions on focus groups, because essentially that's saying that as an activist, as a persuader, as an advocate, you're incapable of changing people's minds or educating them. And I'm thinking, you know, thank God the GLBT movement didn't do a focus group, say, 30 years ago and decide, should we seek marriage equality? And otherwise it'd be, well, no, the focus group said no, so I guess that's off the table. Let's go back to the closet then. And I think that it's interesting that DeSantis comes out with this, even though he knows that sex offenders are specifically excluded. But I think this gets back to the thing, too, is that as soon as you're catering and pandering to haters and bigots and the people that are opposed to notions of equality and justice, basically you're letting them set the agenda. You're just saying that you have such an impoverished, miserly vision of what America can and should be that you're going to let them dictate the agenda, decide what's acceptable and what isn't acceptable. And I think that's a classic case in point. It doesn't matter that the advocates of Amendment 4, you know, they've already done the dirty work for their opponents already by excluding 80,000 Floridians with murder and sex offense convictions. You know, they've already done that. And they're still getting raked over the coals for it, which just goes to show it doesn't really matter. But, you know, they didn't have the vision to seek that in the first place. And so, anyways, I'm the guy that thinks that, you know, if you're actually advocating for progressive change, it needs to be for everyone, not just not just picking and choosing. But I think this is also one of the things that I think that generally the people that are pushing for Amendment 4, specifically the people that are funding it, I don't think they view the criminal justice impacted community as their constituency. I think their main goal, as they see it, is that they re-enfranchise a lot of convicted felons. Enough of those are going to vote Democratic that Florida will cease being a swing state. And I think that's their consideration in this. It's not a matter of, you know, do they really care about felons being able to vote? Do they really care about the successful reintegration of former prisoners into the community and encouraging civic participation, you know, by criminal justice impacted communities? You know, I think that's, you know, where people are coming from is different.
Paul Wright, so what you're saying basically is if the assumption was that felons in Florida would vote in a majority number for Republicans, the people advocating for this amendment would not be for it.
That's what I think. I mean, you know, again, I mean, I don't want to ascribe motives to the people that are funding it, but I think that's the big consideration that they have, because that's the only way I think that, like I say, it's not concerns about felon voting don't seem to have been really a big issue for these funders in the past. And yeah, the fact that they're also coming up with stuff from, you know, based on focus groups rather than, you know, I think other bigger considerations or visions, I think is, you know, I think is kind of telling.
Kevin, we'll throw it back to you here. I think Kevin's point about if political activists who want change try to base themselves on focus groups, meaning what's palatable, what's the lowest common denominator, you sort of have the effect of reinforcing bigotry. And I thought it was completely apropos to use the issue of marriage equality for the LGBTQ community, because there were so many defeats in referendum, even in the 2004 election, 13 different states had referendum. And it was a Republican ploy to, you know, to draw out conservative right-wing and evangelical voters to vote no to marriage equality. And it worked. And so there was this kind of this feeling that was being promoted. Oh, Americans are so backward, and oh, the country's lost, the country's so reactionary. Or, you know, this is just a bad issue for Democrats because it brings out conservative Republicans, so we should turn away from it. But the fact of the matter is that the LGBTQ community people refuse to go back into the closet. They refuse to accept the referendum or any setback in the court or in the electoral front. And people just kept coming out and demanding to love who they wanted to love, to marry who they wanted to marry. And as a consequence of that grassroots massive opposition from the affected communities themselves, it changed the political climate. And then all the politicians announced that their thinking was evolving, as President Obama said.
Oh, I just want to note that it's worth noting that it was President Bill Clinton that signed the Defense of Marriage Act, which, you know, sought to derail the struggle for marriage equality. And of course, Obama was opposed to it as well. So, you know, there was actually no leadership from the political parties on that issue. And I think that, unfortunately, for criminal justice reform, you know, it's a bit much to expect the same people that have been busy caging millions of Americans and policing us for the last 40 years that all of a sudden they're, you know, changing their views on this.
Yes, certainly the leadership's going to have to come from the bottom. And I think that one of the strongest points being made here is that we have the GOP determining the confines of what it is that people are going to campaign for. This is the liberal establishment, or these democratic nonprofit organizations that cater to that party's politics, deciding that they're only going to go for an amendment that excludes people. But by doing that, they're actually starting off from a weaker position that I think empowers people who are on the right wing. Because think about it, if you're excluding murderers and sex offenders, then what's going to stop somebody in the GOP from looking at a Democrat and saying, well, if you can't include them, why would you include the arsonists? Maybe we should kick them off.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if we're not going to include the arsonists, why should we include the burglars? The burglars are committing violence. What's going to stop them from going down the list of other violent crimes and saying that those people need to be removed as well and chipping away at the rights for felons? But if you started at a stronger position, which is that you're going to include every single person because after they've served their sentence, they deserve to be enfranchised and continue to vote. And if that's your point, I mean, I know that there's a separate discussion about whether people should even lose their voting rights in prison, and perhaps that's part of the show, but obviously that's not the issue here with the amendment. So if you start from a strong position of everyone is included, then you're already forcing the GOP to come to your counter vision, which is that everybody should be able to vote after prison. But the Democrats are all about just triage and continuing to lose as the right tugs this country in more of a destructive and hateful exclusionary direction, and essentially all the Democrats can do is offer these Band-Aid measures that don't change the trend. And so when we've had progress in the last 30 or 40 years from the bottom from activist movements, you're actually stunting progress by proposing these kinds of measures.
We are speaking from Chicago with Kevin Gustala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we're speaking with Paul Wright, who joins us from Lake Worth, Florida. Paul's the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Paul, you've got a piece in Criminal Legal News this week entitled Documents Reveal How Law Enforcement Partners with Private Companies to Surveil Schools. The bottom line is there are both private companies and law enforcement entities that are spying on college students by monitoring their social media accounts, specifically looking for things like marches or demonstrations or anything that really is a constitutionally protected right.
Oh, so you start to think that free speech should be the law of the land, John?
Imagine. Imagine. Radical.
Crazy talk. So there's a company named Social Sentinel, and they market themselves as basically monitoring activity by, you know, as monitoring activity by students and also faculty at colleges around their social media activity. So basically, if you're politically engaged, if you're an activist, otherwise not happy with the status quo, Social Sentinel monitors your public posts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, and they provide it to the school police departments. And they basically they market this as a surveillance activity. And it's interesting because, you know, as we're talking earlier on this show about the kind of how things go down the memory hole, and I think, you know, if you go back in the 1970s, a lot of police departments and the FBI were sued for violating dissidents and activists' First Amendment rights by subjecting them to surveillance and subjecting them to monitoring and everything else based on their political views. And when it was litigated, the courts held that this was unconstitutional, that both the CIA and the FBI maintained extensive domestic surveillance operations, as did the local police departments in New York. They called it the Red Squad, which I think kind of tells you who they're interested in monitoring and surveilling.
Remember them well.
Yeah, and so here we are 40 years later. And of course, no one remembers the Red Squad and, you know, kind of the social outcry that happened when that was revealed. But now you have private companies like Social Sentinel that basically they're marketing their services. So it's like their thing is telling police, instead of you guys having to do it, we'll do it for you. Just pay us taxpayer money and we'll do the dragnet on social media and let you know what's going on. So I think that this is kind of like the latest, you know, the latest development, I think, in political surveillance of dissidents. And it's interesting is that, you know, in these cases, the students that are being surveilled tend to be the politically active ones, the ones that are using social media as organizing tools. And it's also interesting is that, you know, when you look at media coverage of the so-called Arab Spring, of activists in Tunisia and Egypt using social media platforms like Twitter to organize protests and everything else, and it's viewed as, oh, this is, you know, this is a good thing if they're doing it overseas. But then on the other hand, what's happening here in the United States...
Yeah, they don't like that so much.
Yeah, they don't like it so much, and then it's, we need to surveil these people and target them for repression. And then, of course, I think the critical thing here is to note, that you know, no one is claiming that these students are doing anything illegal or unlawful. You know, basically, they're exercising their First Amendment right to protest, which they have a complete legal right to do under our country's constitution, yet they're still being, you know, they're still being surveilled. And I think one of the things that it does, too, is it there's a chilling effect. You know, I think that's one of those things that it's one thing to tell people, you know, you have a legal right to do something, and by the way, we're going to track it down and surveil you and keep track of it so we know exactly how you're exercising those, you know, those First Amendment rights.
And I think that's probably the goal. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from Chicago by Kevin Gustala. Kevin is a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we were joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.